Welcome to the Lean Health Tech Podcast, where industry professionals discuss trends and topics where efficiency, healthcare, and technology meet. My name is Taryn Shipley, and I'm your host. Our guest speaker today is Sarah Covington. Sarah is the head of legal at Tracy Health, law professor, and law school textbook author. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Hey, thanks for having me. And if you don't mind, as the attorney at the table, I'm going to start by just throwing out a quick disclaimer. Today's discussion is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute any legal advice. We aren't forming an attorney-client relationship between you and I or any future listeners. Make sure you seek the advice of counsel if you have questions about a particular circumstance.
A true attorney. All right. So today's topic, as you can probably guess, is all things legal, laying down the healthcare law. So let's start off by providing some context. Sarah, can you give an overview of the key legal issues currently affecting the healthcare industry and why they're important for both professionals and patients to understand?
I think one of the things that's really top of mind is this cross-government inquiry that we're seeing by the FTC, the DOJ, and HHS into private equity in healthcare. And of course, the concern there is that we're putting profits over patients in those types of arrangements. And so we are seeing some activity in that space. And I think that that's going to be really key as we continue to move forward, because we saw so much being invested into startups during the pandemic. And we're starting to see some of these startups are getting to the end of their runway. They're also getting to the point of maturity where it is a natural time to be looking at some of those types of transactions. And so I think what we're seeing here is a timing issue where we're going to start seeing a lot more in this merger and acquisition space, but we're also at the same time sort of aware that this is definitely on the regulatory radar, so to speak. We also have an RFI that's open right now for Medicare Advantage plans. So there's definitely a little bit of focus in that particular segment. And also recently layoffs transpired and the CEO has asserted it's in part due to Medicare Advantage. So I think that's definitely going to be something that we continue to see activity around. False Claims Act should always be on this list, always, right? Because it's implicated. And this really matters to our providers because this can't just be something that is put on the back burner or outsourced. It really has to be something that they are keeping in mind because it impacts their licensure. Also, anytime we have to rely on prosecutorial discretion to avoid jail time, that should definitely be something that stays on that radar. This is important for patients too, because they should be tracking those EOBs and identifying services that they've received that are appropriate for their circumstances. Also, when we're talking about patient impact, I think reproductive rights definitely has to be on that list. This is a very unsettled area of law. Just this morning, I saw an assertion that providers in Louisiana are performing C-sections for circumstances that wouldn't normally have that type of procedure just because they're wanting to avoid any appearance of impropriety. And so when you have an intersection where legal is sort of dictating how some of our providers are approaching practice, that definitely then is impacting patient care. And whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's going to then affect public perception if patients are seeing those kinds of headlines, and it may impact how patients then are approaching seeking out that care.
I think you're spot on with the example of the C-sections. I recently read somewhere that the U.S. has the highest rate of C-sections, not because it's necessary, but because we're trying to avoid that malpractice, and we want everything to be very controlled. When it's a natural birth, things are kind of unpredictable, like do you need an emergency C-section, or what medications will we need? Where there'll be complications with the birth. C-section is very, I guess, pun intended, cut and dry. They know what to expect. They have more control over it, even if it's not necessarily what's best for the patient.
Right. And that also then is getting into practicing defensive medicine, and that's sort of how we would label that approach. Yeah. And the impact then to patients, because we know recovery times are very different post C-section than they are vaginal births and the complications associated therein.
Yeah. And for reproductive rights, I mean, the Alabama court case ruling when it comes to IVF, they deemed embryos that were formed in petri dishes to be humans, right? So if you dispose of your IVF embryos then it's essentially committing murder. So it brings up all these bigger questions of, do we have to implant all of the embryos? Are we going to be implanting women with like 5 embryos to the point where it endangers her life? And if people do IVF, do they have to use every single viable embryo? And it's all of these additional questions. It's like opening Pandora's box, right?
Or conversely, are we just going to send the embryos that are unused from Alabama to a different state and then destruction is performed across state lines? And then what implications does that have in terms of jurisdictional reach? It is a very complex concept for sure to mull through. And I think we're going to continue to see evolving decisions in that arena for sure.
So let's pivot to the cybersecurity attack, Change Healthcare. Very hot topic right now. Well, because of the cybersecurity attack, United is not paying out any claims. This happened, I believe, February. It's now end of March. Larger healthcare systems and especially smaller clinics, they're scrambling to make ends meet right now. So what are your thoughts on that whole situation from a legal perspective? Do you suspect, I mean, well, there are class action lawsuits. Do you suspect United Healthcare or Change Healthcare will be held accountable? Will we see any change in legislation around maybe monopolies in the space?
Well, we're definitely already seeing a probe that has been launched into that. And we know that when the Change acquisition was first contemplated, it was challenged, and that challenge did not hold up. So I think that that's going to be revisited from a legal perspective. Absolutely, we're going to see class actions. But I think the tenor and the pace is maybe going to be a little bit different than what we're sort of seeing in the chatter on social media implicating. And that's because these lawsuits take years, and it will be years and years from now before that's settled. And so I think there's sort of this urgency because there is an immediate cash flow problem. But the legal fallout from any lawsuits that are successful is not going to be immediate. It's not going to be the solution that solves this crisis tomorrow.
That's a great point. I know the clinics, the smaller clinics especially, that are on the verge of closing are getting a measly like $30 from United Health Group as a way to help them through it financially. And it's not even gifting $30. It's like a loan that they have to repay. So it's, I think United Health Group and Change Healthcare as a whole, they had an opportunity to really make things right and provide great customer service and say, yes, we can continue being a monopoly because we're doing the right thing and we are serving people in a great way. They completely missed that opportunity. I think they handled this very poorly. And I hope you're right that things will change, even though it will take several years.
It's definitely heartbreaking for those that are being forced into those circumstances. I know of a couple of health systems, even, we sort of think of them as being a little bit more insulated, that last week were having to borrow funds to make payroll because of the impact they were facing. And keep in mind, when we talk about health systems, some of these hospitals within these health systems are critical access hospitals, and those margins are extremely thin. And so as health systems then are having to make decisions about cash flow, we already know we have so many critical access hospitals at risk for closure this year. I think that we will definitely see some trickle-down effects in some of those types of decision-making.
And you mentioned mergers and acquisitions earlier, but the Change hacking is actually causing an increase in merger and acquisitions because they're now going around to these clinics that are failing financially and saying, oh, you're failing financially because we're not paying you. We'll just buy you instead. So it's almost like they created a quick sale for themselves. They created an environment where everyone's failing. So they're the only ones that have the funds to purchase and scoop up all these other businesses, which is another question of, is that legal?
I am seeing that transactional activity. I think that there's probably a little bit more background there. I think some of these transactions were already in contemplation, and that what we're seeing is really a byproduct of an escalated timeline for those. That's certainly probably not the case for all of them, but I think we kind of have to be careful when we're making those broad generalizations that I think some of these were already in the pipeline. And I think we're also going to continue to see that. I don't think Change, though, is the only player in the field that still has funds. I think they're the most prominent right now that we're seeing. But I think we're also seeing this transactional activity with other players in the space as well.
So shifting away from the Change topic, we could spend hours, days talking about that. There's so many details and caveats and considerations, but Let's talk about legal issues when it comes to artificial intelligence, because in 2024, the primary goal of chief medical informatics officers across the US was to implement artificial intelligence. So, what should they be keeping in their minds when it comes to legal implications of using those tools?
All right, I think that we got to set the stage here a little bit. And this is like an area where I'm just going to get on my soapbox for a hot second. The FDA approved the first AI algorithm back in 1995. AI is not new in the healthcare industry. It's become very recently popularized and mainstream, but it's not new to healthcare. In fact, we've been using pagers, faxes, and AI concurrently for almost 30 years. That's the framework that we have, right? I think as we are seeing more AI enter into healthcare, which I think is a little bit more appropriate framing for this, we're going to continue to need to be mindful of discrimination, right? So the data that was used to train the algorithms and then the data that is continuing to be input is going to be a prime focus, right? Because we want to make sure that what we're creating are equitable solutions. To that end, there are also significant privacy implications with that data. Where is that data sourced from? As that data is being used, has that been consented to? And then also ownership. That was definitely an area of interest for me last year. As we see AI sort of entering this player space, who owns that from a copyright perspective? And we've seen some really great decisions already addressing that, and that we're really keeping the focus here on that human component in the United States in terms of ownership of those AI creations.
I applaud you for calling out that AI is not new because so many times I speak with people and they're like, oh my gosh, it's going to revolutionize healthcare. And I'm like, wait a minute, we've been using AI in risk scores for how long? We've been using AI. I mean, the definition of AI is something along the lines of, and don't quote me on this, but it's technology taking data as an input and outputting some other type of data, whether it be a score or a decision or a recommendation or a word. But if you think about it, Excel, you can input a formula in Excel, feed in a large body of data, pump it through this, formula, all these logic pieces, and output it. And that technically is AI. I think people think of AI as some black box mod magic or generative AI, but that is such a small subset of AI. So I love that you called out that AI is not new. It is popular. It is becoming, the sexy topic of healthcare right now. But yeah, it's been around and it will continue to change healthcare maybe at a more rapid pace than it has in the last decade, just because of I call it the democratization of AI because of ChatGPT. Now everybody can interact with it and kind of understand its power a little bit better. But yeah, I agree. The biases we have to watch out for. Where are they getting the training data? Are they training on my input, are they using me to train the model? And the answer is often yes. Specific example of how I see healthcare organizations increasing their use of AI is using those large language models like ambient listening. So you start an app on your phone and it listens to the entire clinician-patient interaction and summarizes a clinician, it drafts a note, like a progress note or a visit note. So there are a lot of concerns around data privacy there that you now have a recording of everything you're telling your provider. And there's concern around the providers because they're going to be expected to have a greater throughput. Like here are all these great AI tools. They'll make you more efficient so you can see more patients. But at the same time, we're going to be holding those providers to the same standard of manually reviewing and manually documenting in patients' charts. So it's kind of like a double-edged sword, is here's this great tool. If you use it, you can work faster, but you still really have to do all the manual work because if AI messes up in court, it will be expected that you manually reviewed the chart, that you manually completed this, right? Like the expectation is the same for providers, whether they're using AI or not. Is that an accurate legal assessment?
Certainly. And to that, I would add, I think there are significant malpractice implications when you have full recordings of conversations that transpired, because as we all know, a conversation doesn't necessarily capture the entire nuance of an interaction. And so that becomes, I think, a little bit more challenging also for practitioners as they're seeking to protect themselves and escalates the bar then for written documentation after that type of visit has transpired.
It makes me wonder how soon we'll start to see video recordings, right? Because, like you said, the nuances, you can't necessarily see maybe a facial expression change. Maybe there's a physical gesture. I'm hurt here. But audio can't capture the whole visit, is what you're saying. And I agree.
So now, are we talking about putting cameras in our exam rooms and patient rooms, which, as we're concerned about privacy for an oral conversation, I think just kind of escalates those implications even further when you now have a video involved.
So we kind of touched on this earlier, but the healthcare industry has seen a trend towards consolidation. What legal hurdles do companies doing mergers and acquisitions face? What impact do these activities have on competition and patient care?
Okay, so I'm going to take a different road on this one than's probably expected because I think there is some real value to these consolidations if they're structured under some very finite circumstances. Obviously, we know that competition is really great because it helps breed much better environments for our patients to receive care. But I'm going to talk about this a little bit just from the rural perspective that I have. And as we have providers that have served their communities tirelessly for years and years and years, and they're looking at transitioning out of practice, but they're not quite there yet, and they're scaling back, going through a consolidation process and having a pathway for that provider to still be able to be involved in the practice of medicine, but in a little bit lesser degree and still involved in that community, I think is a huge step forward, right? So I think sometimes we talk about consolidation and it always has this like bad flavor in our mouth, but I think there are definitely some circumstances out there where it actually enables care to continue to be available in communities that wouldn't otherwise have access to it. All right, that's it. We'll get into the bad flavor ones that tend to stick with us a little bit more. And that's where we saw this with health systems a number of years ago, right? They started buying up the local clinics, and now regionally, we definitely have pockets where there is no competition, where it is just that health system operating within that space, or there's very little competition such that it's not really making a dent in the marketplace and driving that health system to be competitive. And that's where I think we tend to see a little bit more concerns with the co consolidation that has transpired and where we really need to pause and take a step back and make sure that it's patients that are being put at the forefront, right? Not profits, kind of back to that FTC, DOJ, HHS probe that is transpiring. In terms of how this impacts patients, it can be very hard to seek out second opinions if you feel like you're in an environment where you're not getting the care that you need. But there's really not a competitor that you can go to for that care.
Looking forward, if you have a magic eight ball or, crystal ball, what major legal changes do you anticipate in the healthcare sector, and how should healthcare professionals prepare for these changes?
But I think what we're going to continue to see are challenges to well-settled principles. And I think the Supreme Court kind of opened that door for us wide open with the review that we had of our abortion approach, right? And with that, we know we have Chevron before the Supreme Court. And that is potentially kind of huge for us as well, because what the Chevron doctrine indicates is that as long as an agency's interpretation is reasonable, even if it's not what that judge using settled principles of statutory interpretation would have come up with, we're going to give deference to that agency. That decision is up for review. And if we don't have Chevron, what that means is that we won't have as much uniformity. And we're going to go through sort of a piecemeal timeframe where we will have things that had previously been settled challenged. And now we'll have judicial interpretation, which might be the same as the agency. Great. Might be different. That might also be good. But it's going to create kind of an unsettled body of law that we'll be working under for the next few years while that kind of works its way through the court systems. We also know that the Corporate Transparency Act, just launched in January 1st, has already been ruled unconstitutional by a district court in Alabama. We're expecting an appeal. I think we're expecting probably even more challenges in other district courts. And so kind of uncertainty about where that's going to end up falling. I think we're also going to continue to see some rollbacks from the pandemic, right? During the pandemic, we sort of opened the doors wide open, like, hey, just come get care, come as you are. And we've seen a lot of rollbacks, and I think those are going to continue, and that the formulation that we're going to end up with is going to be different than we started with before the pandemic, but it's not going to be the same as it was during the pandemic. And so solutions and service plans that have been created around those existing regulations are going to need to be adjusted. And so I think we're also going to continue to see some movement in the direct primary care space, where we have practitioners that are just sort of taking a step back from this whole insurance body and regulatory changes and just providing care on a direct consumer basis because it is much more simplistic. And so I think those are some of the big challenges that we have coming, is just in general, like, it's always changing, always.
Are there any last words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to share with folks when it comes to legal matters and healthcare?
Yeah, I always say that you should have an attorney at the table. My role as a practitioner is to help enable patients to receive the care that they need. And we do that by making sure that we remain compliant, because when systems are set up that aren't compliant, those patients aren't going to be able to continue to receive that care for very long in that type of structure. It's highly regulated, like we were talking about, and it's constantly evolving. And that's really where the role of counsel comes in.
Thank you so much for sharing information on all things legal and healthcare.
This concludes today's Lean Health Tech podcast. If you're a listener and would like to hear a certain topic covered in future episodes, please let me know by leaving a review or comment. Thanks for joining, and be sure to check out the next episode.